very puzzled about lack of self-confidence, since you are...
It doesn't have to do with grades.
Well, it never does.
That's the point, is it? Purely psychological grades. Mm. My form of neurosis is good.
And but here you are, a much loved and treasured only son.
True.
By anybody's standards, successful and successful early, in your own terms.
Fairly early. I never was trying to do. I was never top of any form of school. Never.
Yeah.
And if I never came anywhere near, through enormous hard work, I never learned Latin or Greek properly. So I used cribs.
A persistent doubt about your intellectual capacity.
Oh yes, certainly. An extreme acute knowledge of lack of depth. And lack of, so to speak, something to say. And hatred of saying something without anything to say. I can't go on trading. I'm the opposite of Freddie Eyre, who's written 40 books, 30 books, beautifully written, in excellent English. Never. No repetitions. Lucid, best English prose, philosophical prose style since Mill, I would say. Never hasn't had an idea in his life. I mean, beautiful, expounding the ideas of others, she believes, modifying them, arguing about them, yes.
But I'm still deeply puzzled by someone who is tremendously good talker in private. Not merely good, but consequential talk,
yeah.
Private, has substance, and who says he's terrified of public utterance. I can't
absolutely
see why the transfer between one to the other should be so daunting.
It is so. Face for the silent audience, instead of saying, ah, capture audience, and do what I like.
Yes.
Exactly the opposite.
But you must have, by the end at Oxford, been such a... had that audience in the palm of your hand.
That's
you could have read the phone book,
I mean,
for God's sake.
I have no idea where they were. I've never seen a face.
You look off into the middle distance.
Top right.
Top right.
Never top left.
Why not? Why
can't
not?
Tell you. I'm telling you about...
These are neurotic
fixations.
Symptoms.
Yes. Neurotic symptoms. Top right and upwards.
Yes.
If I meet an eye, I say to myself, it's because... it might smile or yawn, or the unconscious, a bit like that. I said, ooh, you look at the button on the man's waistcoat. One day, the man didn't come. He didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I have to fixate myself on some still point,
yeah,
and then just emit.
Yeah. Whereas in person, face to face, you fix me and other interlocutors very directly in the eye.
Absolutely.
So I still don't get it. Why?
Well, it's just like a sort of acrobat.
Yeah.
We can only think about
getting to the other end of
the rope.
Yeah.
So it's no good looking at the audience. Am I doing well?
Yeah.
Don't you think I'm wonderful?
Because that's akin to looking down and you might fall off.
Anyway, I feel unsafe.
Yeah.
Obviously. Insecurity is directly.
Yeah.
Most of the thing. And sort of not knowing that I might stop in the middle. So I'm not sure what I'm going to say. You see, my lectures always take the same form. I made 50 pages of notes, which I throw away. In this case, not, but normally is. These I boil down to about 10 pages. The 10 pages, I boil down to a page and a half, mainly of headings, with few little marks, in case I'm struck with aphasia.
Right.
Then I did look.
Right.
And wind myself up like a clock, clockwork clock,
yes,
and proceed to go to the end. The relief that is being always enormous.
Mm.
And I always often start with a sort of silly joke in order to, I'm sure, to ingratiate myself. That's called captatio benevolentiae. In the Middle Ages, it's one of the tropes which of rhetoric.
Yes.
Captatio benevolentiae is the first thing you make a friendly. So you begin by saying, I don't know what I'm doing here, I've lost my notes, I'm totally ignorant of the subject, I'm here on false pretenses, etc. Or some, I have a regular joke I used to make. So I used to ask people at the back if they could hear me. And if they said yes, I would say, well, there's not much point in asking, because you can't hear me, you can't hear this question either. And they used to freeze a laugh,
and then you feel better.
Yes. Which means, obviously, that I need some kind of assurance of being well received.
Yes.
From non-hostility.
You have said of yourself that you have a hysterical desire to please. Is this working
well? Hysterical, maybe a little overdone. I have it, yes. Anxiety to please, certainly.
Yes.
Certainly, I mean, that's why, on the whole, you say, I don't like talking to anybody. I meet somebody I theoretically detest. I immediately start talking to them amiably. Mr. Murdoch,
yes.
Whom I met at a large party,
yes.
In honor of say goodbye to Mr. and Mrs. Reagan, given my Mrs. What's her name, Mr. Graham.
Yes.
As I never greeted them when they first came, I didn't quite see why I should say goodbye to them. How I went. And there were the Murdochs.
Yes.
And so amiable must I have been, they didn't met me somewhere and began talking.
Yes.
Then his wife was a sort of pretty blonde, and also began talking. In the end, they invited me to Thanksgiving in Colorado.
Gracious me.
2 days later, I didn't actually go. No, no. I said I couldn't, I wouldn't. But still, here is this horrible man. Horrible.
Yes, true.
Very bad man.
Yes.
Very bad.
But you talked to him.
A lot of harm in England, no doubt.
Yes.
Probably in America, too.
Yes.
You see, my disapproval strongly.
Yes.
I can't deny that he does a lot of damage.
Yes.
And I never defend him if anyone attacks him. And yet, I must have been so amiable as to be invited to Colorado a private plane. On first acquaintance. Correctly.
Yes. Yes.
You see, it's very shameful. You can't deny.
Well, it's a venial sin, I would have thought.
Or another sin. All the same, I meet Mrs. Thatcher. I don't shiver with hatred.
Hmm.
She always says the same thing to me.
Which is?
When we meet, we don't meet very often. Meet twice a year. Maxim, he said, are you gainfully employed?
Really?
I said, no, I'm not. Why not? I said, I'm very old, I'm retired. No excuse. I must go and write something immediately.
Really?
Go and do some work.
Really?
Can't go on like this.
In a jesting and bantering tone.
Yes, yes.
Yes. And you smile back ingratiatingly. Well,
not quite. Not quite as much as I would somebody I liked. I think I'd smile more to the Prince of Wales if he said that.
Yes.
There's a man.
Yes.
You see? Anyway, I can tell you about myself in that sense. I talk fast and like that in order to make myself agreeable to people, I'm sure.
Yes.
And feel ashamed. Quite a lot of the time. H.P. Taylor. I once asked him how he was a prize lecturer, as you know. He said, well, he walked for an hour, so got up early. And he lectured 9 in order to see how many people would get his lectures.
That's a point of vanity, I thought.
Oh, yes. He wouldn't have denied it. 9:10, I think it was. 9:05, some particular thing like that. He said he walked on Edison's Walk, which is a Magdalen garden, as you know.
Yeah.
He used to get up at 7, in a leisurely way, breakfast. Then about 8 o'clock, 8:15, start walking, preparing lecture in his head. Then at 9 he would begin. First half hour was absolutely all right, I mean, information was given. So he said what he meant, and then the second half hour, pure ham, on which he was ashamed.
Yes.
That's what he told me. I believe this to be true.
Yeah.
That's why he was such a popular lecturer. Half an hour, he then started saying anything he liked and making awful jokes and attacking people.
Right. Well, let's shift gears slightly. We should talk. Last time we talked, we had reached St. Paul's. We've got you through St. Paul's.
We got to the end, did we?
Yes.
Did I tell you who my friends were?
I think you told me who your friends were. And then the question came, which we didn't get to. Why Oxford? Why not Cambridge?
Oh, because that was automatic. That was if you did classics.
Yes.
The tendency. But it might be either. Somehow the St. Paul's decided for me. Oxford and Cambridge. I called Oxford, maybe not Cambridge, and Oxford.
Yes.
So they said, go and try Baylor.
Yes.
Which I did.
Yes.
Not only didn't get a scholarship, it wasn't off the place. Rejected totally.
Rejected.
In 19... 20. I think it must have been spring of 27.
27.
Spring. I was 18. Not quite. Yes. 17 or 18.
Yeah.
Spring of 27. Could have been the late 60s. I didn't think 26. I think it was the old. The idea was to send me a trial run. Yeah. I will get it. They said my classics were good. The Viva didn't go at all well. So that was it.
Yeah. How do you remember yourself at 18? Were you? Do you think of yourself now as a kind of callow youth, or rather sophisticated, or what?
No, not sophisticated. And so were my contemporaries. At St. Paul's, because there were all these, the opera theatres and galleries.
Yes.
St. Paul's boys were very knowing by the time they were 16.
Yes.
By the time they came to university, they were exhausted. And they couldn't have trusted themselves, because of all the callow youths.
Yes. Were you disabused and knowledgeable like they in the same way?
I was sophisticated, yes. I mean, my contemporaries, I didn't read T.S. Eliot, but they did.
Yeah.
But I must have read that kind of thing. And I thought about musical theory, and I thought about that kind of thing. And I traveled to Bonn in 1927 for some concert on Beethoven's original instruments, for Beethoven's Sardine.
Right.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I certainly was sophisticated, yes. I didn't know what I read. As a matter of fact, I wrote an essay for the school essay prize, which I got. I never top of form, but I did get a couple of prizes. The essay was on something or other, and the man who corrected it said it was all like an Oxford and Grades essay on philosophy, so that's where I was going. He himself came from Oxford.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever thought about Cambridge particularly. I wouldn't have minded. Oxford is a natural path.
So not Balliol and not, it was Grades where?
I'll tell you what happened. Yeah, Balliol was a failure. I remember sitting in that hall, cold and cheerless, and looking at a portrait of Cardinal Manning. It was peculiarly repulsive. Severe, skeleton-like, sort of skull-like head, and terrifying appearance. I think Newman was much better, but Manning was Balliol, but Newman was a Trinity. And feeling I wasn't doing terribly well, still. So that was a kind of disappointment, not acute, because I had another year. Then Corpus Christi College, Oxford, which had not taken boys from St. Paul's for about 20 years, because of what I'm telling you, because of charlatans. Because they were all right there, clever, but not solid. No. Corpus was a small college of 90 undergraduates. Then, mainly classics. Very well endowed, created in the founded, I don't know what, in 1959, St. Paul's, or even later, sort of Renaissance humanistic college. But small and sort of modest, and well meant to be good, but not brilliant. Rather like Denmark. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The passport is all right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite all right
yeah.
to be in Dane or Norway, yeah. or something
or
very
corpus.
Respectable.
Yeah.
Very respectable, but not. And they offered a scholarship in modern subject, which for them was a tremendous departure. And that meant honor mods, which is classics, and modern history. That's about as original as they could get. You must realize St. Paul's, you were not allowed to do modern grades. You were not allowed to do PP. It was a perfectly good Oxford examination. It began. In 1923, 22. So, forbidden. Very conservative, a little crazy. But they're all nice, in a way. Home from home.
Yeah.
It was cozy, it's home.
Yeah.
Everybody rode, everybody had to play football, everybody played cricket, because it's so small, everybody got everything. And if you wanted, if you got a blue, or spoke at the union, slightly disapproved of.
Yeah. I mean, so it was inward.
Showiness.
It was inward.
Very beautiful. Yeah. Rather than showy. Not the atmosphere of Corpus. Anyway, I came into this exam, and I obviously wrote quite a good essay. My classics weren't very good. But the essay was all right, and the journal papers were all right. I got it. To my surprise, I got it. Then, I was sent for by the ancient instituter, who was a man called Dr. Grundy, who by this time was about 72 or 3, and the old statues could go on indefinitely. He was a grumpy old military type who had written quite an important book on economic factors of Greek history in about 1980, perhaps, and had not done very much since. But there was a book of Thucydides in his age and the Great Persian War. And the second volume of the Great Persian War found no publisher, the first book in itself. He was bore what he used to call British warm, the kind of British military coat, reached down here. He went to a board, lived in board, came to a boarding house in Kensington, sent for me and killed me. My classics weren't terribly good, and I wasn't at all amounts, because if I did, I wouldn't get a very good degree. I was proceeded straight to grades and do ancient history and ignore philosophy. Straight on this. And I was terrified. There was a severe-looking Don, old, grizzled white hair, but he was a character.
Yeah.
I remember later days he said, told me about the truth kind of thing. He ran in a hoplite's armor from Athens to Marathon to see how quickly the famous runner gave the news of Marathon to Athens could have run.
With every local Greek peasant splitting his sides.
I can imagine. He also said to me, I was standing on the platform of a bus, and suddenly a man reached for my pocket. He was going to pick it. I knocked him down. First man I'd knocked down for 8 years, he said. That kind of thing.
Right.
That's the kind of stories which accumulated around him.
Yes.
He was anyhow.
So you took his advice?
One moment.
One moment.
I did. I came up, and I agreed not to do on the years. I didn't do on the mouth. That meant I had to do two pass examinations. And then I did grades, became interested. My philosophy tutor was excellent. He was no good. The interest at all, Grundy. So it wasn't possible. Nobody at Corpus got a first in the school. Examinations for, I think, 10 years. I think I better tell you what kind of college it was, as far as the senior common room was concerned. Before me, there was a man called Hilton, who had later come to news because he was a Paul Brown with Blunt, McNeese. There's a rather bad book just been written, another spy book, by a man called Costello, which I looked at. It's very boring. Enormous amount of work went in it, and it's inaccurate. But anyhow, it's a bit like Chequia. And Hilton is the first time he's mentioned. He was a mathematical scholar, as Blunt was in print, and got second in mathematical motivations. And thereupon said he wanted to do PP, for social studies, philosophy, politics, economics. His tutor, who was a man called Dr. Piddock, who was mad in his own way, accused him of disloyalty to his subject, mysterious offense. And his scholarship was taken away. Literally taken away.
My God.
I mean, it's inconceivable anywhere else. By that time, in either university. Modern grades was called girls' grades, or American grades. People didn't know Greek. Scholars who knew Greek were not allowed. Mathematics is a real subject. Modern grades is absurd. And you couldn't get a tutor in it. Nobody in Corpus taught it. Now then, he is to go to scholarship taken away, and then at the end he got the John Locke Prize, which was the chief philosophy prize in the university, and got a first. Then his money was given back to him in a lump, I think. And that didn't give him any interest on it. But anyway, he then became an archaeologist and finally an alien spy. He was an ordinary intelligence officer.
Yeah.
So I did nothing against him. But he was the first person in Corpus to do this at all. 2 years senior to me. I did grades. I knew enough Greek for that. I didn't get alphas in my ancient history papers. I got what's called a bad first. I got enough, I wasn't violent at length. I did get it in a formal violent mint.
Yeah.
Marks were good enough.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the man who examined me, one of the people examining, wrote to my tutor, who said he's quite good, not a flyer, like Crossman, Svengali, somebody else, a lot of people then came to asking me to.
Yeah.
Then my tutor, who had a certain faith in me, was a very modest, extremely hard-working Scotsman from Edinburgh, who was a very, very good tutor. He exhausted himself. He died of my teaching. Persuaded me to come in for... Then I did PPE for a year. Now, Christopher allowing me came up. One person had been allowed, couldn't my scholarship be retained for his inferior, had to do history. I think Professor Pritchard, who was professor of philosophy, I think moral philosophy that he was, did say to them that if a person refused, he would complain to the university authorities, and corpus people would not be allowed to go into intercollegiate lectures. They would not, I mean, because defiance of the rules of the university was very serious. And you would see to it, the corpus was expelled from the general collegiate arrangements. Well, threats of that kind, saying, it's monstrous, unheard of. He's perfectly right.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Not to let people do.
But they want to,
with you.
Yeah.
And so then I was grudgingly. Well, I just went on doing philosophy as before. When no graduates, there was no, we filled with no graduate studied modern humanities then. There were a few, but
yes.
It wasn't very common. And then I did economics. I got a very bad tutor, so I never learned it. To this day, I know none. Politics, I had no tutor at all. I still have to read newspapers.
Really?
Literally. So,
it's a miracle. It's a miracle you survived this miseducation, as I.
Well, I got quite good first. And PPE is the standard, really lower than grades. And I got rather bad first. In grades, I got rather good first. In modern grades, after 1 year's war philosophy. My examiners were Ryle and Oliver Franks. I complained that in the philosophy papers, I only did one question, occasionally putting 3 and 7 when the subject strayed towards another question. I didn't divide them up.
Yes,
I did a long essay, which is relevant to about 3 questions in the paper.
Right, right.
Yes, I know. But I was very happy at corpus.
Yes.
I did not row, because I have a bad arm, and it was a birth injury, and I didn't have to play cricket because I didn't want to. Perfect, all right. Much enjoyed at school. I told you about my cricket career.
Yes, hitting the ball straight up into
That's
the
air. That's right.
Yes.
I did not play football. I didn't play any games at all. That was perfect, all right, in Oxford. But in my second year, I had a friend called Calder Marshall. In St. Paul's.
Arthur Calder Marshall,
who is now about 80. Must be a relative in 81. Who became a novelist, but not a really good novelist. He's a daughter, I think, that was an actress. He's a great friend, and he's a very sophisticated boy. And he became a communist some years, perhaps still is. And he became editor of a thing called Oxford Outlook, which was a highbrow Oxford periodical published by Blackwell's. Before him was somebody else, before him Auden, and before Auden similar.
Yes.
Like, it's sort of highbrow periodical anyway. And he passed it on to me. So I must have been sufficiently, so to speak, familiar in what might be called intellectual circles.
Yes,
that I'm in Oxford, to have been given this. And I
so you edited it in 1930.
1931.
What do you remember about editing it?
What?
Do you remember any of the pieces
you
either wrote or edited?
I didn't write very much. I made a commission things. There were two periodicals. One was called Farrago. That was aesthetic and rather charming, and had elegant essays by sort of elegant writers. My periodical was severely highbrow. Wrote about Cocteau and wrote about, I don't know, wrote about sort of intellectual issues.
Yeah.
My contributors, I made it a condition that I shouldn't have to meet the contributors because I think there was a kind of homosexual society I didn't really want to mingle with.
Right.
And some of them were. They were good writers. Well, who did I publish? Goodness, I can't remember now. I got Humphrey House after the game, well-known critic, was a friend. Crossman, I'm not sure, but there was something for it. Stephen Spender said it. quite a lot. My new, my second year. There's a sort of very sophisticated thesis about transition, about choice, much more that sort of thing. It was very unusual. I did write in it. I wrote editorials. I had a row with, quarrel with Prince Mirsky, with a well-known
critic of Russian literature.
Yes, who by this time was on the way to be a Marxist. You know, he converted himself.
And then returned.
Went to Russia with Danin for the war.
Ghastly
story. Awful, yes. But he was already sort of getting on towards it. And it was something I didn't much like. So I argued with him, and he wrote a severe answer. We had quite a good political argument. Pages of Oxford Outlook. I wrote music criticism under the pseudonym Albert Alfred Apricot. I can't tell you why. I did that. I reviewed them. I was always urging the opera club to do things like Wozzeck. They couldn't possibly have done.
Oh, yeah. So you had avant-garde tastes, advanced tastes.
Distinct. And not, I didn't go so far as to. I think I imported Ulysses, which I didn't read then, but later. I gave it. I'd lived my last year when I did PP, I shared a house with a man called Bernard Spencer, who was a poet, quite a good poet, who fell out of a train going away from Vienna well after the war. He worked for the British Council. Never missed a suicide or an accident. The volumes of his verse, which are quite respected. He wasn't a major figure anyway. Very nice man. And then there was somebody called Coppleston, who went to the Treasury, who did the entire money to the university via the UGC. It was called Cop, all by the translators. I was married to a black girl. And then somebody called Corey, who I've lost sight of. But we were fairly highbrows. I went through the Martin Cooper, who was a music critic, and ultimately, and who was Freddie, a contemporary, here younger, made friends with him. He was with the Philosophical Society, Herbert Hart, philosopher, both of my highbrow friends. Stephen Spender, I told you. Horton was down. McNeese never. Yeah. Didn't like you, didn't like me.
Why?
Difficult to say. Nothing in particular happened. But somehow I didn't get on. I met him about twice. He was too grand, too aesthetic, too arrogant.
Yeah.
I think that just took a strike to me. No particular reason.
But you must have at this point begun to feel this was where you wanted to be.
Oh yes, I was very happy. I went to endless literary societies and listened to Harold Acton read the Irish Lords aloud. I went to Union, I went to everything. I mean, I was in a state of continuous vitality. But what I liked best of all was meeting all these public school hearties, where people such as I'd never met before in my life. All these, there were not many of Eton or Harrow, but a lot of people from Rugby, and Haileybury, and Marlborough, and under Winchester. And they were completely different from anyone who was a Jewish day boy in London. See what I mean? And they were much free, in a sense, quite different, extremely gay, frightfully agreeable, very gentlemanly. I thought they were wonderful. I liked them very much. They liked me. My anxiety to please worked. And I became perfectly accepted by a Philistine, rowing, games playing set of persons.
Have you kept friends with any of them?
At the same time, I was obviously an intellectual and had friends on the other side, but it wasn't minded. Because I appeared to have friends in both camps.
What attracted you about Hearty, Hale?
Oh,
right,
I think simply the vitality and the gaiety, the fact that they lived jolly lives. They were unpreoccupied.
Yeah.
They laughed a lot.
Yeah.
And they constantly produced jokes. And they were always, I don't know, somehow there was something rather in those days. This was before the financial crisis, which altered things in Oxford. 31 was a crucial date. This is 28, when I came out, you see. What did I like about them? A certain easy humanity.
Yeah.
You see, they weren't very hearty, they weren't very, sorry, corpus, as I told you, was Denmark. It didn't go too far.
Yeah. Do you have you retained friends with any of corpus that kind of...
Corpus didn't take anybody below a certain intellectual standard.
Yeah. Ah, so they weren't... See,
they weren't totally...
They weren't brutish.
Stupid. No. Yeah. None of them were. None of them were, that's the point.
Have you retained friends with any of people who would fall into that circle?
No. You asked me this question. When I used to go to Gordy's corpus, my generation, I was in very happy times with them, yes. I used to know who they were and chatted together, but amiably. Have I retained any friends? Were any of the ones who stayed in Oxford, I suppose? Who was there? I don't think any of my contemporaries became dons in Oxford.
Yes.
Funnily enough, at least not the humanities. Philosophical bounds, he went to Liverpool, I think. There were a lot of corpus philosophers, but none of them exactly went up with me. It was a film, it was a source of philosophers in Oxford.
Now, on the intellectual side, did you...
So it's a good question. I'm trying to think, how could I have not retained some contacts? There was a man called Jerry Corns, who was a near Olympic runner, who became, went to colonial office, and then became, bought a school, which was preparatory school, which he was the headmaster. I retained connection with him till about 10 years ago. Then I didn't know why we drifted about. He used to come to lunch when I used to meet him in London, that kind of thing. Very nice man. Sent down for drunken behavior. A little bit. Then Spence, I kept on terms with the poet, certainly. Otherwise... Oh yes, somebody, vaguely. There was a very nice man called Kenneth Robinson, became headmaster of the... was a Yorkshireman, with a strong Yorkshire accent, became headmaster of Bradford Grammar School, whom I tried to teach to talk Southern English. And I would say blood. I would say blood. I said blood. I'm saying blood. Did I remember?
Were your intellectual orientations coming fixing on philosophy at this point?
Yes, yes, yes. I became absorbed.
What was it that absorbed you?
Not desire for the truth. I think the challenge, my tutor, was extremely searching. Once I produced a sentence, he'd start criticizing it. And I suddenly realized one had to be very meticulous, know exactly what I was saying, but it's a kind of challenge. And that absorbed me, that stimulated me. It stimulated to be able to formulate propositions which would pass that particular test. I think more that than anything.
Yes.
But I became a conventional Oxford realist, which is what they all were. And I became interested in the problems themselves. I just did become interested. I mean, it is clear that when Moore, G. Moore gives an example of what it is to be interested in philosophy. For example, if you, supposing you ask yourself, where is the image in the mirror? Now, what do you answer?
Yeah.
You say in the mirror, but not the glasses in the mirror. On the mirror, not the repository stamp which will fix the mirror.
Yeah.
It says it looks behind the mirror, which isn't there when you look. Well, what does it mean to say there is an image in the mirror?
Yeah.
What does in mean? If you press your eyeballs and see double, what do you think double of? Which is the real image? Which is correct? Which is incorrect? How can you tell? At what distance, how much do you have to stand to know what it really looks like? How do you know that's the right distance? What is the test? That kind of thing. Puzzles.
Yeah.
Of that kind. And I really did want the answer. Ethics interested me. They were right and wrong, good and bad. That was a genuine interest. I wish to know that. I was taught Hegelian philosophy to start with, which I found unintelligible, frightfully boring, and got out of as soon as I could.
But you were drawn to English precision.
Yeah, I liked English and the English honesty. The great thing about philosophy in England, unlike philosophy in Germany, or philosophy in France, it's plain, it's sometimes rather, not to be profound, it's sometimes rather blunt, it's very honest. There are very few British philosophical charlatans. Not casting clouds on the subject, not cheating, not rhetoric. Not like German philosophy, we simply enter cloudy region. We don't quite know what the word means.
Yeah.
Or even France, where meditations begin, or with lots of paradoxes, which are brilliant but not entirely intelligible. You see what I mean? English philosophy from Bacon onwards, it's what people in the continent like very much, is rather penny plain. It's not coloured. That it really is so. I don't think any Cambridge philosopher ever. I mean, people like literature produced occasional epigrams, but even they, in some sense, always had a perfectly clear meaning, rather profound, rather ambivalent. But they weren't like Hegel or something, where you don't know where you are. Yeah. The Hegel one feels like Polyphemus' cave, with his description, I think it's in Virgil, where all the footsteps face the same way, nobody comes out. It's called Vestigia Terrent. The footsteps terrify.
Yes.
You see, everything going that way, nothing facing this way. That's what Hegelian philosophy is really like.
When you say you were a conventional Oxford realist...
I read Kant. I couldn't understand a word.
Really?
I sat there to begin when I began reading in English. I sat on a boat going down the Danube from Salzburg, from Linz to Vienna, and sat there trying to make out. Did it in the end. I mean, there's all between commentaries and
things.
It became intelligible.
Yes. When you say you were a conventional Oxford realist, what did that mean? What did that mean in 1930?
That particular school was what Russell invented before radical positivism. Russell didn't hold this.
Yes.
Russell, Moore, Cambridge philosophers. In Oxford we had Broad and Cambridge. In Oxford we had Price. And we had Michael Neal, and we had Ryle. All these people believed in the existence of material objects. And in an outer world, you see, and some of them believed in sense data. You didn't see objects, you only saw data which had to be somehow connected with some sort of causes, which were perhaps objects of scientists dealt, and so on. It was a very common sense philosophy indeed. That's the point. Speculative or romantic in any way.
Were you ever pried off it in your philosophical career, or did that remain bedrock for you?
Still bedrock in a way. Either I was pried off, yes. Yes. I mean, when I began reading people like Schopenhauer, or I've never read Heidegger in my life. Shameful but true. I've never read Sartre properly either. I think it remains. I had some kind of naive realism. I think it's true of me. Show me. Sort of Missouri-like notion. I'll tell you. When I read Russian thinkers, not philosophers, political philosophy mainly, I realized it was inapplicable to politics, not very applicable to ethics.
That kind of realism.
Yeah, that kind of method of worrying things out in a very exact way.
Yeah.
You see, what I mean is this, that analysis, so-called philosophical analysis, when applied to ethical propositions, tended to leave dust behind it, little pebbles, which is not what you meant. There's a very extraordinary statement to be made by all people, Russell, whom you would least expect. I would least expect that particular statement, which is that in order to understand somebody's philosopher's general doctrine, the fundamental doctrine is fundamentally basically simple. And you have to understand what that is. The cleverness and brilliance goes into rebutting possible objections and argue for it, but not the doctrine itself.
Yeah.
The, as it were, the castle which is defended is easily grasped, and that has to grow first. The stuff on the walls, all the instruments which lob all the balls against the enemy,
yeah,
and all the various methods of repelling attack, they can be of infinite sophistication and brilliance and ingenuity. But you never understand what a man meant by only understanding that. If you follow somebody's argument, it will not lead you to what he really believes. It may or may not be true, but I believe that.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of theory of knowledge or logic, that isn't entirely true. Probably, obviously, if you read Frege or even if you read Russell, you accept the conclusions, you might be traced back to the premises. Like Hobbes, you remember, said, but Euclid, by God, this cannot be true. And then he traced it to its source,
yeah,
what it was, and then adopted the method. It's obviously true of logic, up to a point true of other philosophical theories. But in the case of value theory, what you have to understand about political theories is how they see the world. First thing you have to see is what their values are, or how they conceive of society, relationships of people in society, the ends of men, goals, means they use. That is not necessarily contained in the ingenious arguments which they use to rebut.
But that means you have to, they have to be seen historically.
Well, you have to empathize. No, you have to empathize. You have to understand what they're defending, what kind of viewpoint, what is the world which they see, what is the form of life as they conceive it. Yes, certainly historically. Or contemporary too, equally. But
yeah.
I mean, I can understand what Solzhenitsyn wants by understanding the kind of world as he sees it. Never mind about what he says about the Soviet Union, I mean, what he criticizes, maybe that's right. But that's not the point. You see from what point of view it's being done.
Yeah.
Then you understand it better.
Yeah.
But this is certainly true of political philosophy, because exact application of exact methods, we will have done, of course,
yeah,
in Oxford and elsewhere, seems to me to lead to added results.
Yeah. Now, this raises a question I was reading this morning when I was about to come to you, your wonderful essays on Austin, your kind of éloge of Austin.
Indeed. There's much criticized for it. Freddie, I was present in this meeting. See, it was a thousandth meeting of the Summit Society, and Price had to read a paper on Oxford philosophy in the 30s. I had to read one on the 40s, and Ryle read one in the 50s. And no, I did on the 30s, Price, and Ryle did the 40s. Price really did do the 20s. I talk about Austin there, not much about there, and Ryle talked about himself entirely, and he mentioned nobody else at all. Now, Freddie asked to my wife, who is present at this meeting, I don't know what he means about it. I'm the only person who counted. I'm the only person who's important. He wasn't important the least. I was in the 30s. Trust me, nobody else. I was wrapped up in knuckles in it.
But Adair made the very perceptive point about Austin that he was a greyhound who wouldn't race, he just nipped.
He bit the others. They wouldn't run either.
Yes. But the question I wanted to ask you is how you see yourself in retrospect in those conversations. The paper is a wonderful description of debates between Austin and Adair.
I took part in them. There were five people there in my room. It all began in All Souls. In 1936. The only people who came were Eyre and Austin, and when he became a fellow of All Souls in Hampshire, at the end of 36, and a man called McNabb, who was a fellow of Pembroke, and I don't know if the Woosley came, it was a philosopher. I don't think it came. It must have been somebody. We all knew who it is. Of our age, you see. These are all people under 30. girl who were 20s. Not more than 5. And as I said in that paper, once we satisfied each other.
Yeah.
And I thought of, I think I argued in favor of one proposition endlessly, which was discussed week after week after week. I'll tell you how it began, chronologically, it's quite amusing. In 1933, there was a question of importing German refugees into England, Jews. And I thought, Rosemargel Cassira, who was a famous German philosopher, who obviously was immensely learned. Boyd of Oxford also weren't immensely learned. We argued quite well, Socratic, but it was not very much accurate knowledge. I thought, well, wouldn't do us any harm to have a man of colossal learning. So I persuaded all souls to take him. He arrived, he was 57, he looked about 80, and we didn't know what to do with him, so we decided to have a seminar. He's about a class. What about? Well, he'd written a book on Leibniz in 1910. We thought it might do that, speaking English. So we imported it, the only people who spoke German, understood German. It was very galactic, the gathering. They came to it, Ryle and Price and O'Neill and Crossman, McCollum Foster, who got a doctorate at Kiel University, with a Yalean, and there, and Austin, and myself, in all souls, as I began. And one of the other people certainly came. And nothing happened. We read the Theodicy by Leibniz. It's such a work. The Theodicy. And we read it in German, French, and so on. And somebody would ask a question,